From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 31st day of January, 2024. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you today from the Conservation Cropping Seminar at the Illinois Department of Agriculture in Springfield. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson. He's at TGM, that's TotalGrainMarketing.com, out of Champaign, Illinois. We'll discuss conservation and farm policy with Jonathan Coppas, agricultural policy specialist from the University of Illinois, and we'll also hear from Drew Lerner today at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
No update of the commodity markets as I'm hosting the Conservation Cropping Seminar at the Illinois Department of Agriculture today in Springfield. However, we do have Greg Johnson with us. He's with TGM, that's TotalGrainMarketing.com. They're in Champaign County, part of the elevator system. Hi, Greg. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here, Todd.
I'm looking forward, first off, to having you at the All Day Ag Outlook over at the Beef House that comes up on the 5th day of March. It's a Tuesday. It's always a great day. You'll be on the corn panel in the afternoon, and it should be a fantastic day. Thank you for doing that, by the way.
Well, you're very welcome, and I think this is going to be a year where we need all the input we can get, all the advice we can get. Prices the last couple of years have been relatively high, and marketing wasn't quite as important, but now that prices are probably getting close to or below cost of production, I think marketing is going to become a very important factor once again this year.
Yeah, this will be both for old and new crop. Can you tell me what the marketplace looks like today?
Corn started lower, no follow-through from yesterday's 8-cent run-up in corn, 25-cent run-up in beans. So we started lower, but we're starting to come back here at the midday. Corn is just slightly lower, maybe a half-cent to a penny lower on both old crop and new crop. Soybeans are down about 3 cents, 3 to 4 cents in the old crop and 2 to 3 cents lower in the new crop. Wheat's down about 10 cents. That's probably dragging the corn down a little bit. So no follow-through from yesterday, but at least it's not a lot lower, so we're hanging on to most of yesterday's gains so far.
Yeah, so last week we were talking on Wednesday, and you were thinking that, hey, we might have a better week than we've had the previous. That really didn't turn out to be the case. I don't know where we stand today in that downward trend. Can you update me?
We made a new contract low in December corn yesterday by a quarter of a cent, but then we rallied 8 cents. So the technicians would say we had a key reversal in corn yesterday. Of course, it was all technical and chart driven, so not a lot of any changes in the demand side, in the actual demand side of the equation yet. So I think traders are looking for some follow through to see if this technical reversal can be confirmed. And so far, we're not seeing that today. So we're kind of, we are higher than where we were yesterday. We're off our lows, but just maybe 3 or 4 cents off of where we were when we were talking a week ago. So we're a little bit higher than where we were a week ago, but just barely. We're still kind of stuck in this sideways channel until we get some new information.
I bet farmers are talking to you some about when they will need to make sales to pay some of the inputs for the new crop, and asking what their opportunities might be. What can you tell them?
Well, most farmers are talking about needing money March 1. So they've got another 4 weeks to wait and see if this market will bounce. They're hoping that the funds that are historically short, I mean, they're as short as they've been in 4 years. They're hoping that some of the funds will cover those short positions, buy back and take some profit. And that would allow the market to bounce a little bit and give the farmers a better chance to sell at some slightly higher prices. But of course, the funds know that the farmers are long, sitting on probably 60% of the old crop corn and have sold very little of the new crop corn. So if the funds can wait it out, if there's no real new news in the marketplace, then the funds may be able to wait out and have the farmers push this market even lower before the funds decide to cover those positions. So we're kind of in a wait and see cat and mouse game, who blinks first. The funds are extremely short, the farmers are extremely long, and on days like today, nobody's willing to change their position much, and so we've got kind of a uneventful day so far.
What will push the funds to have not to wait that out? What would happen in the marketplace that would cause them to say, I can't do it any longer, I have to make a different change?
Number one, we've got a supply and demand report on February 8th. If there's anything surprising in that, that could give us a little impetus. Probably the second thing that could happen, the safrinha crop could get delayed in planting. That might get the traders to assume that maybe the yield won't be quite as good. That could get them to cover. Number three would be some unexpected demand, i.e. China. So those are probably the three things that might get the funds to rethink their short position.
Farmers in a position that's better for soybeans than they are for corn?
Yeah, the soybean price, while it's lower, we're not at the bottom. We're kind of in the lower third, but the corn is right at the bottom, the three-year low. So, yeah, the corn is definitely, from a price perspective, much lower, and farmers just don't want to throw in the towel if they don't have to on corn. Whereas if they sell beans with the kind of yields we had last year, you know, you could argue that farmers are still making money if they sell beans even at $12. So, yeah, the farmers are a little bit more heavily sold on beans than they are on corn. And of course, that's what they want the market to go up on is corn, because that's what they're holding on to the largest percentage of.
Okay. On that note, if they are able to market the soybeans to pay bills on March 1, they're still holding on to corn. Interest rates and maybe in charges will be continue to pile up. They'll need some advice as it's related to the finances behind that, I suppose, and how long they really should wait.
Exactly. And the best thing I can, you know, tell them is this market may not go up until we have a weather problem or some unexpected demand, like we talked about, the safrinha crop in South America or our own crop here in the U.S. Both of those events are probably quite a ways away. So if you're not going to sell on a small rally, if we get the funds to cover just because of some technical, you know, considerations, if we get a small bounce, if you're not going to sell that, you're basically telling us that you're willing to hold on into the summer and wait and see whether we have some weather problems here in the U.S., and that's several months away.
Hey, thank you much.
Hey, thank you, Todd.
That's Greg Johnson. He is with TGM. That's TotalGrainMarketing.com. Jonathan Kappas, agricultural policy specialist at the University of Illinois, now joins us to talk about the conservation-related programs within the Farm Bill and how they work together today, and what things might or could be changed in the future to make them work differently or better. Thank you for taking some time with me. Just broadly, give me the scope of conservation within farm policy.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. It's this topic is has been on my mind for a bit now, and have been digging into it from multiple angles. And one of the things I find sort of interesting or sometimes troubling is if we look at the totality of farm policy. So we have the farm program payments in Title I, we have crop insurance, and we have conservation. Conservation is the smallest of the three, and it is a pretty complicated set of policies. They're incredibly important. These are roughly $5 to $6 billion annual investments into doing natural resource conservation on private lands. That's a big investment, and that is an important investment if you think of public policy and public taxpayer funds. But we also have a series of challenges with these programs. They are vastly oversubscribed. On just a national average for the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, about twice as many farmers get through the application process and approved for funds than there are funds available. So that means we are leaving a lot of farmer demand to do a lot of conservation on the table for reasons that are beyond their attempts to do it or even the agency's attempt to operate the program. This comes down to funding. There simply is not enough funding for these programs for the demand that we see from the farmers for them. They're complicated. They require a lot of time and effort to get the application through. And so we have an opportunity to rethink these things, you know, when we reauthorize farm bills. And so I think that's a big part of this, of the conversation. But they're both an important investment and insufficient. They're not enough. And I also think there's a set of challenges with conservation policies, programs and practices, particularly those working within the working land space. So within the farm production, not something like a CRP that's taking acres out of production for a 10-year stretch, But there's a lot of complications that go with that. And if we think just in terms of cover cropping, if we think about cover crops, we're looking at that programs and policies that pay a portion of the cost. They don't cover the additional cost. They're not taking into account risk issues, crop prices, and yield challenges. It's not incorporated in crop insurance. It's not incorporated in the Title I program payments. And so we're kind of siloing this off in one set of programs, underfunding those programs, and not incorporating some of the real-world challenges that farmers see, particularly in the working lands type practices for conservation.
Give me an example of EQIP, those funds that you talked about first. What kinds of structures, what kinds of things are put in place?
So EQIP, annually Congress allows or provides about $2 billion just for EQIP. Half of that is just for livestock production operations. So we're starting to cut down the amount available for working lands conservation. Even within that, there's a big competition for whether it's irrigation practices or the things that, like cover crops and no-till that we see here in Illinois. The other side of this then is from the farmer's perspective. Not only is it possible that, you know, you go in and get signed up and approved and there's still not funding for you to do the practice, it only covers a portion of the cost. So if we think about farming and we think about the intense competition at the local level and the challenges a producer face, we're going to take two farmers. One of them is not going to do conservation. One of them wants to do conservation. How does that play out in their bottom lines? How does it make the conservation adopting farmer less competitive, particularly in a short term? How does that challenge your conversation with landlords and cash rent? All of these things factor into it. If there's a yield drag in the first year or two, how do you manage through that as a farmer? The risk issues of having a growing cover crop, for example, in the field in the spring when you've got a narrowing and difficult planting window. All of these things play into it, but our policies are not adapting to those sets of challenges. And so I think that's an area where we could get innovative and creative with policy to look towards encouraging this practice adoption by farmers and helping those farmers who want to do more, and stay competitive and stay profitable and stay functional within the system.
Land is a natural resource of the nation. The taxpayers are looking, I think, when they move dollars from the federal government to farmers for some kind of return. How should we think about that in the whole, from the farmer's perspective and from the taxpayer's perspective?
So we invest, as a society, we invest a lot every year into farmers, whether it's conservation, whether it's supporting crop insurance, or whether it's this Title I program set of payments. We have seen time and again in the Gardner surveys that we do that the public is very supportive of helping farmers adopt practices for natural resource issues, for soil health, for erosion, for nutrient loss. We see that over and over and over again, that is one of the highest areas of public support for farm policy. Again, what I think our challenge is we've not broken down these strange bureaucratic silos between here's funding for doing these practices, here's funding for, you know, revenue or price losses. We're not looking at the ways in which conservation can be better incorporated in our risk management and in our crop support policies.
Wouldn't it just be easy to put those to fund them, relatively speaking, more fully, possibly through premium reductions in crop insurance or other places?
Well, I hesitate to agree with the word easy on any part of this because we're a year behind on reauthorizing a farm bill. So clearly any of this is not easy. I also think there's a lot of reason to be very cautious with crop insurance. I think there are interesting arguments, particularly around the premium subsidy component and how that looks. But again, we want to be really careful because it is a nationwide insurance program in which changes in one part of the country, like Illinois, could have substantial impacts on how the program operates. This is where actually I think we're missing an opportunity with Title I, with the farm program payments. We could probably pilot ideas in Title I that have little that would not have a detrimental impact on farming the way a problem in crop insurance might. And so again, we can look at, you know, how do we think about the yield challenge for the first 3 years maybe of a cover crop or even a no-till practice change? How do we think about programs and policies that help the farmer work through that, manage through that, doesn't put that farmer at a competitive disadvantage with neighbors or other farmers around them? How do we think about what that revenue situation looks like in those first few years? And maybe that can adjust over time. And then that could be something that could be talked through in a crop insurance setting, understanding that it's so much more complex and difficult with crop insurance.
So off the top of my head, then you would take either ARC or PLC and let's, for lack of a better word, use supplemental coverage option of some sort, SCO, added onto it that would account for potential yield drag.
That could be one option. I mean, here, you know, another example is we've got the trend adjusted yields that we added into the ARC County program back in 2018. You know, what kind of trend adjustments or yield adjustments could we think about in ARC that would help with this sort of 3 to 4 year learning process with a new practice like cover crops? Are there ways to boost that? Are there ways to protect against that? And then can we learn from that from an insurance standpoint? I hesitate to jump right into the insurance system with a lot of these practices and policies just because of the complications and the potential that one change in one place could impact insurance elsewhere. But with Title I, we have a lot more to work with a lot less potential unintended consequences in the program. So yield issues, price issues, the revenue challenges. How do we think through what those policies look like? And this is one of the things that I'm working on and we're talking with a lot of the farm groups and conservation groups about. You know, we're realistic that this farm bill is, should it move anytime soon, is going to struggle to get probably too creative and innovative. But I think this conversation can get started and we can work through a lot of this over time. And then, you know, you come back to the other issue and the reality of the budget challenges for a farm bill, which is complicating our current attempts at reauthorization. There isn't new money. There isn't a lot of new money. There isn't an easy path to just plug in new money for these programs. So, you know, it's easy to say, well, we need more. We need twice as much in EQIP. Where does that funding come from? Particularly given the budget process in Congress, you know, adding $1 billion is adding a $10 billion cost structure to the way Congress has to work through the budget. So I think it's another reason to call for creativity and innovation and how we can intermingle or blend up and some of these program ideas and concepts so that we stretch our dollars more. I mean, ultimately, we're paying, you know, billions of dollars, sometimes $5 to $6 to $7 to $8 billion in Title I, another $5 to $6 in Title II conservation. How do we blend those? How do we stretch those dollars better and get more of the benefit for the taxpayer who's funding those programs, as well as to the farmers who want to adopt practices, want to help improve soil health, cut down erosion, and cut down nutrient losses? How do we find those innovative points where we can benefit the farmers and the public?
I suppose in Washington, D.C., it's always important for all of the participants to recall that this is a cooperative effort between the taxpayers, the landowners, and the farmers.
It would be very helpful if the larger public concerns and perspectives were strongly considered in all of this. And I think we're seeing right now a challenge with that, whether it's the Inflation Reduction Act funding for conservation that is kind of on the menu of things that some interests want to redirect or reuse. And I think it's important that the public's perception on this, the public concerns, the demands for cleaner water and less dust storms across interstates in the spring, those sort of things are very important to us. And we have got to think through that in our policies. It is not as simple as moving money around. It's an important and difficult question about complex policies in a complex environment like farming, where the risks are immense throughout the growing season, the risk of nutrient loss after harvest, before planting, all of those things are really important. And I agree. I think there's a big need to incorporate more of that public voice and those public concerns because these are public policies using public funds.
Thank you much. That's Jonathan Kappas, of course. He's an agricultural policy specialist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Let's check in now with Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, like me, is traveling today, although you're a little farther from home than I am. I'm only in Springfield, an hour and a half from Champaign. How far are you from Kansas City? I take it you're in Canada again this week?
I am. I'm in Calgary, and I'm not really sure how many miles that is. It's a long ways. It took all afternoon and evening to get here yesterday. So, but you know what? Last week when I was up here, it was like 20 or 30 below zero. Last night when I got here was 50 degrees. That's plus 50.
Wow.
Fahrenheit. So what a difference. I'm telling you.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. This is part, I guess, of the beginning of this atmospheric river that will be bringing rainfall to the West Coast. And can you tell me about that and what it means for the Midwest and how the two are related as relationship between current temperatures and the mild weather and these atmospheric rivers, if they're related at all?
Oh, yeah, they definitely are related. You know, the we have a strong ridge of high pressure that is building up over a big part of North America right now. And that's why these temperatures have been so far above normal here the last few days and still expected to go even higher yet. We saw temperatures over 70 degrees along the Kansas-Oklahoma border yesterday afternoon and 60-degree readings all the way up on the Canada border in Montana. So lots of heat. Well, that building ridge is in response to the atmospheric river that is developing out across the Pacific. And just as a quick refresher, an atmospheric river is nothing more than a concentrated jet stream that's bringing one storm system after another over a same region. And in this particular case, the jet stream is running north of Hawaii and extending from there to the California coast. And that's where it will likely stay through a big part of the coming week, with some southward shift taking place as time goes along. So what that will do is keep the ridge over the central part of the United States for at least the next few days, and then ultimately will push it to the heart of the Midwest and the Atlantic Coast region as we get into the week next week. And that's one of the reasons why we won't see much precipitation in the Midwest. But boy, if you're in California, it's a whole different story. One storm after the other, and some of these are going to be really big. And so we're going to end up with some flooding, some damaging wind, and some crazy amounts of mountain snow that will take place. And it's not just a California event. It will impact Nevada, southern Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and portions of northwestern Mexico. So all of that region is just going to get clobbered by a lot of moisture. Flooding will be common along the coast, along with wind speeds on the California coast running from 30 to 50 miles per hour, and probably some higher gusts once in a while with a bigger storm, which will probably come along as we go into, there's actually two of them, one of which will be probably Thursday into Friday. The other one will occur next week. And mountain snow, maybe 3 to 6 feet, will occur in the Sierra Nevada, and we'll probably see some rain totals in Southern California and Arizona surpassing 2 or 3 inches. And if you remember, about a week or week and a half ago, the San Diego area had a terrible flood event from a similar amount of rain. So we're going to have to watch real closely. We do expect to see flood problems and wind damage, and there's probably going to be some disruption at the ports, San Francisco down to L.A., and travel in the area is just going to be kind of horrific. Eventually, some of the energy from out west will come into the middle of the country, but that is probably going to occur rather late in the forecast period. We get one weak system coming through this weekend that will impact Nebraska to the Delta, but the next system will probably hold off until the second half of next week, at which time we will see rain finally developing across the Midwest.
Turn your attention then to South America. What are your assessments of both the crops in Argentina and Brazil?
You know, Argentina is back into the dry saddle again, and really taking it on the chin at the moment. Buenos Aires and parts of La Pampa have been without rain for 3 weeks. And up until this week, the temperatures were actually a little cooler by us, so they were hanging in there really well, and they had an abundance of moisture starting the dry period. But it is getting hot now. A ridge of high pressure will be building up, and temperatures yesterday were in the 90s. We'll be seeing temperatures in the middle 90s through about 104 across a big part of the nation as we go forward through the end of this week and into the weekend, with some extremes of 108 to 110 possible in the northwest. So a lot of moisture has already been exhausted from the topsoil, and so we're running short to very short. But the subsoil moisture in the heart of Argentina is still holding on at adequate levels. And it's just the heat that's going to be hurting crops in central Argentina. But those crops in the south, in Buenos Aires and La Pampa, they are already eating into their moisture reserve in the subsoil, and the stress levels will be high there. And the big concern in southern Argentina is the late double crop beans that get planted behind their wheat crop. And those beans have not established root systems well enough to handle this kind of prolonged dryness and heat. So they may lose some soybean yield or even some production in general because of that situation. On the other side of the fence in Brazil, everything is still pretty good, but some of this dryness is beginning to encroach onto the Mato Grosso do Sul and point southward into Paraguay and western Rio Grande do Sul. And these areas will see another 7 days of dryness, just like Argentina will. I don't think Brazil is going to have much of a problem, though, but we will be watching closely. Both countries should start seeing better rains beginning to evolve a week from now and through the following weekend. So there is an opportunity for relief, but it is going to be tough on Argentina until then.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world at the Conservation Cropping Seminar from the Illinois Department of Agriculture in Springfield. I'm Todd Gleason.